Welcome to Ask the Coach, a series of exclusive conversations with the most successful strength coach in the world, Coach Charles Poliquin. This is Poliquin Podcast number 6, Training for Soccer. Now, here is Charles in conversation with John Connor.
Today we're going to interview world-renowned strength coach Charles Poliquin on the Training for Soccer. Charles, since you've produced medalists in 16 different Olympic sports, how would you rate the training of soccer players in the world today?
Soccer, as a group, is about 30 years behind, at best. I would say on average it's about 45 years behind in the training world. I've never seen a pro sport as disorganized in terms of modern application of exercise physiology and strength training.
Do you have examples of this? When you look at the sport, what leads you to say this?
Well, for example, if you go around the top soccer teams around the world, the level of physical qualities is quite under par if you compare it to other sports. For example, if you compare the top soccer players in a World Cup versus the top hockey players in a World Cup, even though they're two different sports, I mean, the level of the physical qualities is dramatic.
Like if you were to compare vertical jumps in both sports.
Vertical jumps, ability to repeat under conditions of fatigue, power output, elastic strength, maximal strength levels. For example, it's not for a lack of funds. You got a team like Manchester United. If they were to say, all right, we're going to catch up those 30 years in 1 year, which they can do, the level of soccer would change so dramatically that it would be an entirely new game, far more exciting, you know, because you could see some real speed out there. You watch some soccer games, it looks like a bunch of Care Bears on Valium. I mean, they have not reached their potential for sure.
So if you were to start training a soccer team, what's the first thing you would do?
Well, first of all, soccer does not have good batteries of testing or normative data. You will find that pretty much every pro league as an idea of what to test. It's not great in most instances, but at least
they test.
They do test and they make an effort of doing it. So there's no central drafting agency for soccer. So if they were smart, they would say, okay, we're going to come up with a battery of tests, test kids, and be able to identify talent. What I would do for soccer, first of all, I would do a structural balance. You got to see what is the potential for injury. I cover that at length in my seminars or internships, or also on CDs and DVDs, so let's push that aside. But outside of that, you need more information than just structural balance. You need to know how much power they can develop. So the vertical jump would be essential. Okay, that would give you a baseline. Also, you need to know what is the elastic component of the athlete. I would do probably a penta jump for that. Single-legged, so they've got to jump on an elite leg, cover in 5 steps the longest distance you have. That would tell you how much they can switch from an eccentric to concentric contraction, so it would be a good speed indicator. The next thing I would do is I would do a 40-yard test, or 40 meters, and then I would install a set of lights every 5 meters. What would that do is that would give me why is the athlete not as fast as they could be. So the time between 0 to 5 yards or 0 to 5 meters would indicate, for example, their ability to overcome inertia. So if the guy's got, based on normative data, fairly good speed, but he's pathetic at 0 to 5 meters, then we know that if we do increase that athlete's levels of maximal strength, he will be able to overcome inertia much better and his speed will improve dramatically. So he'll be able to get the ball much faster than his opponent.
With the vertical jump component, just for comparison, what are good levels in other sports?
Well, you know, obviously there's some sports that require a greater vertical component. I mean, let's take volleyball, for example. A vertical of 40 to 48 inches is international standard. Most soccer players can't jump over a flat credit card. So, you know, I would think they would need at least 30, 32 inches to be at a optimal level.
With the panda jumps, you said you'd do 5 jumps in a row, single leg. Would you measure each jump individually or just total distance covered?
Total distance covered.
would measuring it individually give you any more information? Or
yes, if you have the ability to do that, but it's not always available.
Okay, so we have vertical jumps, panther jumps, 40 meters. Is there anything else you would add to the testing?
Obviously, I would do an overhead throw with a load, you know, just to see how far they can throw.
A caber toss or?
No, actually, straight overhead throw like that you would do in soccer.
Any weight room lifts?
Actually, the sport is in its infancy, so I don't think we need to test power snatch, full squats, and stuff like that, because, A, they don't even know how to load a barbell, so it's kind of pointless to do that, maybe in a few years from now. This is why, actually, I'm writing a book right now on soccer training for teenagers. I think to start at the top would be a mistake. Obviously, if you know, I got an offer from a big soccer club tomorrow, I would probably take it, provided the money is good. But the point is that if we do want to change the sport as strength coaches, we have to start with the youth and build from there.
In soccer, would you have an optimal body fat percentage? I know in different sports, like you say, a sprinter should be 4% and work it from there. What should soccer players be?
They should definitely be under 8% because of the amount of speed that they need to deploy.
How would you visualize 8% on a soccer player?
Well, with his shirt off, you could probably see his pancreas secrete insulin when he's carbohydrates. I'm just kidding, but at least you would see a very well-defined abdominal wall where you see every single row of the abdominal wall. Based on what I saw at the World Cup, it's not always evident.
Charles, what are the common misconceptions in soccer training at the moment?
Well, first of all, a lot of them consider it being an aerobic type of sport and they overload the kids aerobically. It is not an aerobic sport. If you look at what they call time motion analysis, actually 80% of the time, you know, they're not doing much. So it's actually a sport of repeated sprints. So one of the things that should be included and tested is the ability to repeat sprints under conditions of fatigue. So you would need to develop a drop-off test, which could easily be done based on time motion analysis. A lot of soccer programs will say, well, you should come in and, you know, run 10 miles, 20 kilometers and stuff like that. That has zero carryover to the sport. Another thing that's really important with soccer training, and now ice hockey has finally figured it out, is that you could do all sorts of energy system training, but if you don't have the sport implement with you, that doesn't really carry over. In other words, all the conditioning drills should be done with a ball because you should try to kill two birds with one stone. Otherwise, can you control the ball and not get fatigued doing that? Because just running around with no ball means nothing. So in ice hockey, what you see now is that they used to do what they call power skating. So they would hire these figure skating coaches and they would show these hockey players perfect technique, you know, but the guys had no stick and no puck. And then what would happen, these guys would practice all summer this perfect power skating technique, and as soon as you would put a puck on the ice and hockey sticks in their hands, they couldn't reproduce those movements because the movement patterns were gone because they were concentrating on the puck. So now the brighter coaches are doing all the energy system training, puck handling, or at least holding a stick in full gear.
Would you have any guidelines for the work rest period in these energy systems training for soccer?
Yes, I would have guidelines, but only if I had results in the profile of the athlete. So I would have to know what his vertical jump is, what his elastic strength is, what his performance on a repeat drop-off test and so on. Then I could decide, because one athlete may need to concentrate on anaerobic alactic power. One other athlete may need to concentrate on anaerobic alactic capacity. The guy may need to work on lactic capacity. So that's why it's important to do testing, because you can periodize and design.
See what's lacking.
Yes, and the other thing too is that it's obviously position dependent. For example, a goalie, what's going to make a really good goalie, for example, is the ability to overcome inertia and have lateral speed to cover the entire surface of the goal. So for them to run around for 40 minutes, it's not going to do anything for their performance. So, you know, for, let's say, a goalie, I would specialize on things where you do drills with a sled and you do sideways sled dragging, so to improve that lateral speed. So it's actually position dependent and athlete specific.
Another common myth is that the leg extension is probably the best exercise for kicking power.
Actually, it's probably one of the most worthless exercises for determining soccer kicking power. There's a study that showed that the most important muscles for soccer kicking is actually the hamstrings. And because when you kick the ball in soccer, it's not always the same pattern. And if you know your kinesiology well, you know that the hamstrings control foot orientation. For example, the medial hamstrings bring the foot in and the lateral hamstrings bring the foot out. So if you don't have a balanced hamstring development, your kicking power will vary greatly from one type of kick to the other, depending on which portion of the foot makes contact with the ball. So in my opinion, hamstring training is far more productive for kicking power. The same is true in martial arts. We know, for example, for combat fighting, tests done on certain specific ergometers have shown that the power of the kicks delivered by the martial artist was a function of how strong they were in knee flexion.
Not knee extension.
Not knee extension. And knee flexion, for example, a hook kick in karate was more correlated with knee flexion against a low with the foot externally rotated. And let's say a kick, like an inside crescent kick, was with the foot internally rotated. So the point is, you can infer that that data from martial arts does transfer to soccer kicking, and I'm convinced it is.
So for the best results in kicking power, to do a lot of different hamstring work, toe in, toe out, toe neutral,
will translate definitely to improve kicking performance. Like I said, that sport is so far behind that once somebody figures it out, it's going to be quite exciting to watch.
Is there a particular hamstring exercise? Like, would you prefer to do it kneeling, standing, lying, or just once you vary it, that's the key?
There's at least 70 variations of good hamstring exercise that one can use to improve soccer power. So I do talk about these in my internships, and I show them, and I make sure the coaches know how to execute them properly. But yes, there's plenty of exercise that one can do.
You're talking there about knee flexion. The hamstring crosses the hip joint as well. Would you do hip extension as well?
Yes, because if you train the hamstrings only as knee flexors, you're limiting your potential for support, particularly in soccer. In soccer, it's very important that you train the hamstrings as a hip extensor because it will improve short-term speed. And one ability that's critical in soccer is how fast can you get to the ball? So if you have weak hamstrings as hip extensors, your speed potential is very limited.
Is there anything else the hamstrings will help with?
Well, a lot of ACL injuries are common in soccer. And one thing we know in the research is that the stronger the hamstrings are to the quadriceps, the lower the incidence of ACL injuries.
There is also in soccer a lot of hamstring pulls. Is this due to a weakness alone in the hamstrings, or is it going to be tied into other factors?
Quite a few factors. I think the problem in most modern medicine models is that they look at the world through a straw. So they'll say, like, well, you've torn your hamstring, therefore you must have a weak hamstring or a tight hamstring. It's not really true. One thing we know, for example, is that repeated hamstring pulls are often linked to actually tightness in the rectus femoris. So improperly designed flexibility programs will lead to increased hamstring pull. Another thing we know from American football is that the incidence of hamstring pulls and or tears is directly correlated to magnesium deficiency. So mineral status is very important. It's no secret that most soccer players' diet is very inferior. So, you know, they don't do anything special for their diet. You know, you'll hear comments like in soccer circles, taking vitamins is not natural and you shouldn't do it. Well, that would be like saying, you know what, You shouldn't cash every day the royalty checks you're getting from your trust fund, because that's unnatural. You should work for your money. Well, you know, that's quite dumb. Why not take something that would improve performance ethically and naturally?
Do soccer players need to be really that flexible?
There's such a thing as optimal physical qualities. In other words, for every sport, you need X amount of that physical quality. Does the soccer player need to be as supple as a synchronized swimmer? No. But does he need to be more flexible than the couch potato? Yes. One thing that's more important with soccer players is not actually absolute levels of flexibility, but relative ones. What I mean by that is that if you do a good functional assessment of the player, what you will find is that what is the most common cause of groin pulls and or hamstring tears / hamstring pulls is a the common cause of those tears is a offset ratio between the medial, sagittal, and lateral hamstrings. And once that ratio between the three heads of the hamstring is corrected, you will find that the incidence of injuries actually decrease. And that's something that you could easily identify within 10 minutes of a good structural balance assessment.
Is low back strength essential for soccer?
Actually, very important, because lower back levels of strength are directly correlated with the ability to overcome inertia. So this speed between 0 to 30 meters, and we know that for every sport that has lower body involvement, whether it's speed skating, American football, rugby, or soccer, the stronger you are in the lower back, the faster you'll be from 0 to 30 meters.
Charles, how important is upper body training to soccer players?
That's a very big misconception. A lot of people believe that upper body training is negative for soccer training, that it will harm performance, slow you down, blah, blah, blah. Well, that's a load of crap when you think about it, because upper body training will actually increase speed. Every single sport I work with who was lower body dominant was amazed how much faster the athletes got when they started to train their upper body. The reason is that the left upper body, for example, counterbalances the torque of the right lower body when force is applied by the right leg, and vice versa. So when the upper body is in balance with the lower body, people actually improve their sprinting speed. We know, for example, in the sport of speed skating, which a lot of people say, well, that's the last sport where you should do upper body training because you're supported by the skates, blah, blah, blah. What we found is that once the athletes match their upper body strength, their lower body strength, world records starting to get shattered, you know, in the short events, 500 meters, 1,000 meters. So knowing that, and the same thing in bobsleigh, and even in track cycling, if it's a sport where your body is quite supported, it's track cycling. We know that if you increase upper body strength, you do get faster. So the same would be true for soccer. Also, there is some kind of upper body play, even though it's not within the rules so much, but being strong in the upper body will make you better defensively. The other thing is that the spine is a common site of injury in soccer, and having a stronger upper body prevents a lot of these spine issues. So in my opinion, the key is balance. I mean, you don't want to end up looking like Conan the Barbarian, but you still need some. The average body weight in the World Cup, if my memory serves me right, is about 77 kilos. I think the optimal body weight is about 85 kilos. Once the World Cup of soccer, you know, goes up to 85 kilo average body weight, you'll see a much better game. We've seen it in ice hockey. The average body weight when I started work in the NHL was about 85 kilos, and now it's about 97 kilos, but they're on skates. It's different. You know, there's less friction. So if 12 kilos was good for the NHL, I would say for soccer, about 8 would be the best.
ACL injuries are a common event in soccer. is that just part of the game? There's no conditioning that can stop that or lessen the odds of it happening?
No, that's another myth. I worked for 10 years as a strength coach for the National Alpine Ski Team, and I worked for different nations in alpine skiing. And one thing we did see, if there's a sport that is plagued with ACL injuries, it is alpine skiing. Alpine is far more dangerous to the knees than skiing is, soccer is. And what we have found is that by balancing the ratio between the hamstring and the quads, and by increasing absolute levels of strength in the legs, ACL injuries went down dramatically. When I started to work with the National Ski Team, we were told that you would need to have a major surgery in the ACL within 5 years of being on the Alpine ski team. Well, what we found is the kids who started with me at a young age never had a single ACL repaired as long as they were doing strength training. Some guys were with me for 10 years and never had an ACL, and we know we could reduce it dramatically. Actually, once we put the ratio between a hamstring to quad from 57% to 79%, there was an 80% reduction in ACL injury. So in my opinion, from other sports as well, whether it's American football or soccer, anytime you regulate the ratio between hamstrings and quadriceps, the ACL rate goes down dramatically. ACL injuries is mainly a factor of improper muscle balance, in my opinion.
Another common injury site is the ankle. Will your conditioning programs take care of that as well?
Yes, the ankle is a weaker joint, and strength training can offset some of that. But the big plus of doing strength training is that if you do get an ankle injury, the time to recover would be much shorter. That, you know,
why is that?
Because a better conditioned muscle returns to health faster. That's a, whether you're in basketball or soccer, this is a true thing. One thing that's very interesting in the soccer world is that, contrary to all other professional sports, soccer has not caught on yet that, as a rule of thumb, properly strength-trained athletes, at a minimum, a 40% reduction in injuries. And I think in soccer, those injuries would actually be far more reduced because, for example, in ice hockey, you get a puck in the forehead. There's not much what strength training can do for you. And these types of injuries do not occur in soccer, okay? Getting a ball to the head versus a puck is two different things. So I would think that the percentage is much higher. The problem is, the reason why I can't quote a percentage is that
they don't have them.
They don't have them, and nobody actually does good strength training. But the interesting point is that the number of man-lost days in soccer would drop dramatically if they did some conditioning. But the conditioning, in my opinion, has to be done at a much earlier age when they actually have time. Because if you look at the time off of a good soccer player, it's barely 4 weeks to 6 weeks. So that's not enough time to build strength training. However, I think that there's a way to implement strength training in early preparation in soccer so that they could still offset a lot of that. But that's another topic.
So for most of the athletes, you're saying, with soccer especially, the best time to train would be sort of early teens. But for an athlete who is full-time, how can they work this type of training into their training?
The problem is that you need cooperation between the technical staff and the strength coaching staff. One thing that I've seen, I've got some of my better students who are now strongly involved in rugby, and they've been able to educate the technical staff towards doing less running and doing more strength training. And, you know, one of my students, Phil Richards, has done great strides in rugby training by implementing that. It would be a matter of educating the technical staff, but that sort of education has been able to go through in American football and ice hockey, but not yet in soccer.
A lot of soccer teams like to do running ladders, hurdles, parachutes to increase their speed and quick feet. What are your feelings on those implements?
Okay, there's such a thing that's really popular called SAQ. Well, in my opinion, it's a complete waste of money. Okay. One thing that we know for sure is that by age 12, you have 90% of your coordination. So past the age of 12, the best you could do is improve your coordination 10%. Now, running ladders, cones, and all these idiotic drills do zero to improve speed. If they were so great, you could be sure that people that run 100 meters at the Olympics would do them on a regular basis. And why don't they do them? It's because they do nothing. These people will not waste their time doing improper drills, and they don't do parachute pulling or any of that stuff. So instead of wasting your time running through step ladders, unless step ladder becomes an Olympic event, you know, I don't think it will do anything for you. You know, especially if you're a parent listening out there, it's far better that you hire a qualified strength coach in the off season and have your child engaged in a proper strength training program.
Because soccer involves a lot of directional changes, what kind of drills would you bring in for that? A lot of people say the SAQ was to teach them directional changes.
No, what we know for sure, the best way to improve directional changes is improving the ability to switch from an eccentric contraction to concentric contraction. The best way to improve that is actually to get stronger. So strength training does more for what they call agility than agility training. We know one thing that people are copying from me in the world of ice hockey is actually strongman training. So the sort of events that strongman competitors do actually help transfer to the soccer field. So use of the super yoke and the farmer's walk and all sorts of other devices will actually improve the ability to have the directional change, but running around with an elastic band between your 2 feet is not going to do it.
Trip you up.
Yeah.
In most of your sports that you've coached, you always have lifts that correspond to performance. Would you have a lift that would correspond to improved running speed for a soccer player, or, you know, increased kick and speed? I know we've mentioned the hamstrings before, or is there any other exercises that you would recommend for them to do?
Well, the point is that soccer is so far behind, but let's say in 5 years from now, if they start to train properly tomorrow, I would say in 5 years from now, the ability to power snatch and front squat a heavy load would correlate to increased soccer performance, but not right now.
Not right now. What kind of stability training would you do for them, like for the ankle joint, or for the hip joint, for the core, or anything like that?
You do need to do some stabilization, but it should not be, no pun intended, the core of your training program. There are certain exercises that we do with wobble boards and inflatable discs that you can do in general preparation phases that will actually increase ankle stability and strength. But I would say they have a place 3 to 6 weeks during the training year.
For soccer players, you're saying 85 kilos is an ideal weight. How would you work in their workout sessions? Like you said, a normal workout session for you would be arms one day, legs another, rest, torso, rest, repeat. How would you work it for a soccer player?
Soccer players, I think that in the off season would do best with a 4 days a week type of program, where basically 2 days a week they would work south of the belly button and 2 days a week north of the belly button. So, you know, it'd be basically 2 upper body days, 2 lower body days. Then people will, right away, I'm sure, will say, well, you know, it's mostly a lower body dominant sport. True, but you need to work on your weakest link. And the weakest link right now in speed is actually strength ratio between the upper body and the lower body.
How would you work energy systems training into that format?
Well, the energy system training would have to be based on how you do in the functional assessment at the beginning of the year. And then based on what is the limiting factor, you would do more or less of the 6 different energy systems. So that would be on a case-per-case basis. But the basic rule is that you would work the anaerobic systems first, and the power of those systems first, and then the capacity. Once you would near competition, I would actually do the aerobic work, and I would work on the capacity before the power, which is the opposite of what you do for anaerobic training.
I meant, would you do energy systems on the same day as leg training, or leave it to the upper body day when you work it in?
Now, typically, the best way to do it would be to do legs in the morning and energy system training at night. I think that most soccer players would benefit from two high-quality energy system workouts per week only.
In season, with a lot of matches they play, usually with Saturday and Sunday, maybe a midweek game, how would you structure your strength training program with that, and would you do any additional energy systems training as well?
In-season training, if you're going to do any energy system training, again, it's based on team testing, and it should be done with the ball under technical drills, okay? And that's when the strength coach cooperates very well with the technical staff. Probably the best guy in the field is Ventroni from Italy. He used to be with Juventus for 10 years. He's probably one of the most foremost thinkers in energy system training. I do really respect his work. As far as strength training, the goal of in-season training is the maintenance of maximal strength, not the building of it. So if you didn't do a good job in the off-season, you know, as we say in America, tough titty, because it's just too late. What we know from all team sports, whether it's volleyball or basketball, is that incidence of injury climbs up directly in relation with loss of muscle mass by the player. So the more the muscle mass the player loses during the in-season, the more he is going to get injured. So the key in maintenance strength training for the in-season is actually to maintain muscle mass. How much training do you need? Actually, only 20 minutes a week to maintain muscle mass. We're not talking fantastic amounts of work here. 20 minutes of work. But the best day, again, based on research that has been compiled in America and a lot of sports, the best day for in-season strength training is the day after the biggest game of the week.
And with that 20 minutes, that will be a total body. You'd pick maybe one major lift for every muscle.
Yes, basically, what I found from experience when you're concerned with in-season training is to do one set per body part in a 6 to 12 RM range, and that's plenty to maintain muscle mass.
Where do you think soccer teams make their biggest mistake in the field of strength and conditioning?
Without a doubt, the biggest mistake that soccer teams make in the field of strength and conditioning is having the wrong person in charge. Most soccer teams will have the physical or physiotherapist, whatever you call it, be in charge of strength and conditioning. A basic principle in strength training is if you can't get yourself strong yourself, how can you make others stronger? So if you hired a physical therapist to become the strength coach, that would be like saying, I'm rich and famous, I need a bodyguard, I'm going to select a guy that's watched a lot of Jean-Claude Van Damme movies. Okay? It's not because you've read about it that you know something about it. You have to have actually done it. If you look at successful sport organizations, whether it was the Dallas Cowboys, when they were holding football, or whether it was the Chicago Bulls, or if it was the Detroit Red Wings in hockey, at that point in time, they always emphasized strength and conditioning. And if a team invests in that part of the solution, the number of man days lost just goes down dramatically, besides improving performance. But if you look at major organizations in sport, that I'm not talking in soccer, but in other professional sports, they do put a lot of emphasis on strength and conditioning because it's not an expense, it's an investment.
Do you think football teams should have a strength coach?
The answer is definitely, because would you want to save $10 million?
Yeah.
Okay, well, then hire a strength coach because that's all you'll save on man days per year. Plus, you'll improve performance. So, of course, I mean, you look at other sports, they do seek the best people for that, and they do make sure that they're giving the right environment.
A lot of teams now, they're doing Pilates work, yoga, core work. Where would you rate this in the scheme of conditioning?
Well, let's look at common side of injuries. Do people get injured in the core or do they get injured in the knees?
Knee.
The knee and hamstrings. So, you know, one thing with Pilates, you listen to the people who endorse it, they think that it does everything in the fitness world, plus cures cancer, and if you're in trouble with the taxation department, you'll get off. I mean, they tend to exaggerate the claims of what they can do. In my opinion, one thing that every strength coach for soccer should learn is, for example, how to do the Peterson step up, which is how you strengthen the VMO correctly for sport. If you learn to do the Peterson step up properly, A, you reduce the number of injuries to the knee. B, you improve running speed. C, you improve kicking power. Okay, so there are very basic concepts that the strength coach should learn, and they're nowhere known to the level they should be in the soccer world.
Nutrition-wise, a lot of teams will drink basically sugar water. Would you recommend, like I know in other things, you recommend branched-chain amino acids to be taken. Would soccer players take them during a game?
For sure. I mean, one of the things that would increase performance in soccer would actually be to drink an amino acid solution, branched chains, obviously, during the performance, because there's at least 8 physiological reasons why branched chain amino acid solution would increase performance during a soccer match. Just one of them is, for example, tyrosine during exercise gets converted in 5-HTP, which is basically an inhibitory neurotransmitter. It's been shown that as little as a 5-gram dose of branched chain amino acids during exercise prevents that conversion. So it is critical to take a solution that improves performance. Sugared water may maintain blood glucose levels, but a lot of times they tend to actually dehydrate the athlete, and they tend to have all sorts of artificial colorants and flavors that do more harm than good to the client. And another problem that I have with these solutions is they actually contain caffeine, and caffeine increases cortisol. So it actually, you will see these athletes drink that as a rehydration source post exercise, and actually they're loading up on caffeine, which increases cortisol. So actually they decrease their recovery rate.
So if they were to take a BCAA during the game, their performance will be able to maintain longer during the game, and as they go on, there's less chance of them getting like niggly injuries towards the end of the game.
Yes, and also the studies that show that your ability to make decisions during exercise improves if you take branched chain amino acids during exercise. So you're less likely to make, let's say, kicking mistakes or poor decisions while you're taking that product.
We're talking a lot about strength and conditioning. Is there any sort of exercises and stuff like that you could do for decision-making as such, you're saying? Like, is there anything you can employ to do?
Yes, there's a lot of products you could do. Obviously, the thing you should need to do first is what we call a comprehensive metabolic profile. So if I was a pro team owner, I would routinely get my athletes tested for at least every 3 months. But you'll find, for example, vinpocetine and euprosine and other nutraceuticals can increase blood-brain flow, and also speed of transmission of the neurons, which would help better speed with the ball, but also better decisions on the field.
So as regards to decision-making, it's more a nutritional approach than a training approach.
Yeah, because at that point, I mean, they should have played soccer enough in their life to know where the ball should go. But under conditions of fatigue, yes, neurotransmitters levels will impact on whether you're making the right decision or not. So it's like the same as if you were to be in charge of the conditioning of a SWAT team. By the time the guy makes a SWAT team, he knows where the bullet should go, but is he going to make that right decision? Maybe not, because his nutrient levels may be too poor.
If a conditioning coach of a soccer team wants to monitor his team, is there any tools he can use to do that?
Yes, I've developed a software called Stronger Online, which you'll find it on a website, strongeronline.com. It's actually quite a few NCAA teams, law enforcement agencies, and pro teams like the Baltimore Ravens who've bought that software. And the coach can actually write programs online, store them online. So if he gets his computer stolen, for example, he still has all the data. The athletes can log in his performance online, and remotely, the strength coach can assess if the athlete's making the right progress and so on. And if the athlete, for example, doesn't remember how to do exercises, he can go online and look at the video of them and refresh his memory.
Is there an advantage of the athlete marking his progress?
Very much so. There was a very famous weightlifter who was like the Michael Jordan of weightlifting. His name was Tommy Kono. And he said the palest ink is better than the best memory. Well, now instead of inking it down, we could actually type it down. But it's very important to have logs of your training diaries. Otherwise, you don't know what works or where you should be going.
For more information on strength training programs, where would you refer people to?
They can go to my own website and take my courses. I'm developing strength training for soccer internships, and I do run strength training certification programs almost every weekend. And the address is www.charlespoliquin.com.
Thanks very much, Charles. That was very enlightening.
You're more than welcome. Thank you.
So that's it for this Poliquin podcast. Ask the Coach with Coach Charles Poliquin is an exclusive series of conversations. It is for the sole purpose of its audience. Any rebroadcast or reproduction of this is strictly prohibited. It is for entertainment purposes only, and it is not a substitute for professional medical or health advice, examination, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health professional before starting any new treatment, making any changes to existing treatments, or altering in any way your current exercise or diet regime. Thank you for joining us on Ask the Coach. Until next time, be healthy, lean, and strong.